Welcome the learner to today's deep dive. You know, usually when we think about what the universe is made of, we imagine, well, stuff.
Right, yeah, physical stuff.
Exactly. Even if we zoom all the way down to like the subatomic level, our intuition paints this picture of tiny little billiard balls, you know, like quarks and electrons just bouncing around in this giant empty room that we call space.
Yeah, it's a very comforting mental model. I mean, we like our reality to have a physical substrate.
We really do. We want to be able to like knock on wood and know there is something undeniably solid there.
Well, it is the most human assumption possible, right?
Right.
Because we operate in a physical world, so we naturally project that physicality downward.
Right.
We assume that if something exists, it must be made of some kind of tangible material, and it has to, you know, occupy some kind of empty container.
But then you step into the world of theoretical physics, and specifically, the third and final paper in this just paradigm-shifting trilogy we're exploring today.
Which completely upends that whole idea.
It really does. Suddenly that empty container just vanishes. The billiard balls vanish. We find ourselves looking at a landscape of reality that is completely fundamentally different from everything our intuition tells us.
Yeah, it's a massive shift.
So today we are hyper-focused on this incredibly dense, fascinating paper by independent researcher Eric McLean. It's titled The Lattice Between, and it's basically the capstone to a theoretical framework he calls Pentagon Physics.
And, you know, our mission today is very specific. We are not just going to, like, float around in abstract mathematical concepts or philosophical musings.
No, we want the nuts and bolts.
Exactly. We are going to unpack the exact step-by-step structural mechanisms of reality. We're really looking under the hood here.
Right. Like, how does matter mechanically exist, right?
Yes. By what exact mechanism does a particle of light travel across billions of light years without, you know, losing a single drop of energy? And how, on a purely structural level, does gravity actually pull on you?
Which is wild to even think about, because McLean is making the radical claim that the universe isn't made of stuff at all.
Right.
He argues that the vacuum of space isn't empty. Instead, it is this continuous space-filling lattice of four-dimensional geometric structures called 600 cells. So, okay, let's unpack this because my mind is already slightly blown here.
It's a lot to take in.
It is. And I need to figure out how we get from like a 4D geometric shape to the actual physical chair I am sitting on right now.
Well, to understand the mechanism of the vacuum itself, we really have to start at the absolute foundation.
Okay.
And in Pentagon physics, that foundation is not a fundamental particle, and it's not a vibrating string either. It is literally a single self-referential mathematical axiom.
Right. The paper lays out this equation. Sigma equals 1 over 1 plus sigma, which honestly looks like something you would see in a basic high school algebra class.
On the surface, yeah, it totally does. But it actually acts as this infinite geometric feedback loop.
Oh, interesting.
And what's really critical here is that this specific equation has exactly one positive root, which is the golden ratio. You know, we often represent that with the Greek letter phi.
Oh, the Goldie ratio. Yeah, we see that popping up everywhere in nature, right? Like the spiral of a nautilus shell or the arrangement of seeds in a sunflower, even in classical architecture.
Exactly. Nature favors it because it is, well, mathematically highly efficient.
Mm-hmm.
But in McLean's framework, the golden ratio generates a very specific geometry.
Because of how it behaves algebraically.
Right. It inevitably gives rise to a four-dimensional shape called a 600 cell, which you can basically visualize as a perfectly symmetrical 4D crystal.
Okay.
Built out of 120 corners or vertices that are connected by 720 edges.
Okay, here's where I really have to step in and push back, because I know the learner is probably thinking the exact same thing I am right now.
Go for it.
The paper insists that this field, this infinite lattice of 600 cells, isn't actually made of anything.
Right.
It literally says, and I'm quoting here, asking what the field is made of is asking what mathematical truth is made of.
Yes.
I hear that, but like, how can pure math, without a physical substrate, without any actual stuff, give us the solid world? I mean, if reality is just a math equation, why does it hurt so much when I stub my toe on a coffee table?
That is the ultimate conceptual hurdle, isn't it? We desperately want the math to just describe the coffee table.
Yes.
We want the math to be the blueprint and the universe to be like the wood and the nails. But McLean's radical mechanism is that the mathematics is the reality.
Wait, so?
There is no wood. There are no nails.
So the universe isn't just following a mathematical rule. It literally is the rule.
Precisely. Consider the statement 2 plus 2 equals 4. That concept is just true everywhere.
Right.
It doesn't need to be physically built out of plastic blocks or metal for it to be true. It doesn't require some kind of external energy source to sustain its truth. It is just inherently inescapably true.
Okay, I'm tracking.
So McLean is arguing that his axiom sigma equals 1 over 1 plus sigma is simply true everywhere. And because it is true everywhere, its geometric consequence, that 4D 600-cell crystal structure, holds everywhere.
Oh, wow. So the vacuum of space isn't an empty room. It is literally just this axiom asserting its truth at every single point, creating an infinite, continuous lattice of identical 600-cell cavities.
Exactly. The math doesn't need to be implemented in a physical medium. The axiom is the substance itself.
That is mind-bending.
The vacuum is simply this rigid mathematical structure in its natural, undisturbed state.
Okay, well, if I accept that I am living inside an infinite, perfectly rigid 4D math crystal, which is a huge leap, but okay, that leads to an obvious problem.
Okay.
If the vacuum is completely uniform everywhere, what is the mechanism that creates a toe to stub in the first place? Like, how do we get a proton, an electron, or a coffee table out of a perfectly uniform mathematical lattice?
Right, so for that, we have to examine what the paper calls the 3+1 split.
The 3+1 split, okay.
Yeah. To understand the mechanism of matter, we first have to look at the uncommitted lattice. Naturally, this 600-cell lattice has four dimensions, but they're all mathematically identical. It operates on Euclidean geometry.
Meaning there is no built-in difference between space and time. It's just four directions you could go, and they're all treated exactly the same by the math.
Exactly. Most conventional physics assumes space and time are this pre-existing stage that matter just acts upon.
Right, like a 3D spatial stage plus a 1D time clock just ticking away uniformly in the background.
Right, but in this 600-cell lattice, that distinction does not exist natively. All four dimensions are just geometric extensions. So what actually is matter in this framework? Matter is a standing wave.
A standing wave. So like a self-sustaining oscillation of energy trapped inside one of those 600 cells.
Yes.
Like a vibration that feeds back into itself so perfectly, it gets stuck in a localized loop.
That's exactly it. It crystallizes into a stable pattern. But to be a standing wave, to vibrate in a fixed location, it is forced to make a geometric choice.
What kind of choice?
The waves must commit to oscillating along one specific coordinate axis out of the four available.
Ah, it has to pick a lane.
Right. And the moment it chooses that one axis to vibrate along, everything fundamentally changes for that wave. That chosen committed axis becomes what the wave experiences as its proper time.
Whoa. And the other three uncommitted axes?
They become its spatial dimensions. Space and time are not properties of the empty vacuum. The 3+1 split of space-time is actually a property of matter.
Wait, really? Space and time are what standing waves do?
Yes, exactly.
So the universe doesn't have a universal ticking clock. Time is just the specific direction a piece of matter is vibrating in.
You've got it.
That means when Einstein taught us that massive objects have their own individual clocks, the mechanism under the hood is literally that every single standing wave, every particle, is beating its own drum along its own chosen axis.
I absolutely love that analogy, beating its own drum. Mass itself is simply the energy stored in that committed oscillation. Mass is not a tangible substance. Mass is literally the kinetic energy of that chosen time axis.
Okay, so if every particle is beating its own drum along its own chosen axis, what happens when two standing waves, two particles, have chosen slightly different axes for their proper time? I mean, their drums would be beating out of sync, right?
They would. And they would be in relative motion to each other.
Oh.
This is the underlying structural mechanism behind special relativity. When particles move relative to one another, their clocks run differently because they have literally committed to diverging axes within that four-dimensional lattice.
That is so elegant. So matter is a standing wave that has picked a lane, beating its drum, anchored to its committed time axis.
Right.
But matter isn't static. Things interact. Electrons drop energy levels. Atoms emit light. What happens when that standing wave changes its rhythm or, you know, breaks its anchor? How does a photon, a particle of light, actually cross this empty mathematical crystal to reach my eye?
Well, when a standing wave reconfigures, it releases energy. That energy escapes the committed time axis and enters what the paper calls the invariant sector of the lattice.
Okay, but invariant sector.
Specifically, it enters a four-dimensional channel called row 7.
And because this energy is now in the row 7 channel, it is no longer committed to a specific time axis, right?
Exactly. It has no rest frame.
It's just pure, uncommitted energy moving through the lattice at maximum speed.
Yes, but the true genius of this framework is the mechanical explanation of how that energy moves without decaying.
Okay, how does it?
Remember, every single empty cavity in the vacuum lattice is generated by the exact same mathematical axiom. This means every cavity is completely flawlessly identical.
Right.
They all share the exact same impedance.
Now, in physics, impedance is a measure of how much a medium resists a wave moving through it,
right?
Like electrical resistance in a wire.
Precisely. The paper calculates the exact vacuum impedance of this lattice represented as Z0 as being equal to 4 times pi times alpha. And when you translate those natural mathematical units into the standard SI units we use in our laboratories, it comes out to roughly 376.73 ohms.
Wait, really? Which happens to be the known experimentally measured impedance of free space.
Down to the exact decimal. Because every single 600 cell cavity has that exact same 376.73 ohm impedance, there is zero impedance mismatch from one cavity to the next.
Oh, the paper uses a fantastic real-world analogy to make this intuitive. It compares the transit of a photon to a Newton's cradle.
Yes, exactly.
You know, that executive desk toy with the 5 steel balls hanging from strings. You pull back the first ball, let it go, it clacks into the line, and the ball on the exact opposite end flies up. And the balls in the middle basically don't even move at all.
Right, because the energy transfers perfectly through the intermediate balls,
yeah,
since they're completely identical in mass and density.
So because every cavity in the vacuum lattice is mathematically identical, the energy transfers from one to the next without a single drop of impedance mismatch.
That's the mechanism.
That's why a telescope can detect a photon from a galaxy 13 billion light years away perfectly intact. It hasn't degraded because it's literally traveling through the universe's most perfect Newton's cradle.
The vacuum acts as a flawless continuum transmission line.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But there is actually a second, even deeper reason why this transit is completely lossless.
Oh, even deeper.
Yeah, it has to do with the algebraic structure of that row 7 channel the photon travels in. The paper describes this channel as Galois invariant.
Okay, let's break down Galois invariant so we really understand the mechanism here.
Sure. So we established earlier that the 600 cell lattice is generated by the golden ratio, right?
Right.
Mathematically, the golden ratio is deeply tied to the square root of 5. The physical boundaries, the walls of the lattice cavities, are mathematically defined by the square root of 5.
Okay, I follow.
However, the row 7 channel that the photon travels in does not contain the square root of 5 in its algebraic makeup at all.
So the boundary is built out of one type of math, and the photon is built out of another type of math that lacks those specific puzzle pieces.
Exactly. It is a structural incompatibility. Because the photon's channel doesn't share that algebraic structure, the boundary literally cannot interact with it to absorb its energy.
Oh, wow. It's like broadcasting a radio signal on AM when the walls of the lattice are only built with antennas to receive FM.
Yes.
The walls literally can't pick up the signal. They can't bleed off the energy. So they just don't fit together at all, right?
Okay.
The photon passes right through them as if they aren't even there.
Exactly. The transmission is lossless because the lattice cannot read the photon's algebraic structure. It has no choice but to pass the vibration perfectly to the next cavity.
Okay, so light passes perfectly because the lattice is a rigid, unbending mathematical crystal. But wait, if the lattice is completely rigid, we have a massive contradiction on our hands.
Yes, gravity.
Yeah, gravity. Einstein proved that gravity bends and shapes space-time. We have seen gravitational lensing. We know mass curves the path of light. How do you bend a rigid mathematical crystal?
This is actually the central paradox of the entire paper. Reconciling a perfectly rigid lattice with the reality of gravity.
Right.
MacLean resolves this with a really profound mechanism he calls anisotropic coherence depletion.
Okay, that sounds incredibly dense. Anisotropic coherence depletion.
I know, it sounds intimidating, but the concept becomes beautifully intuitive once you separate the substrate from the field.
Okay, so the substrate being the rigid 600 cell cavities and the field being what exactly?
The paper refers to the field as coherence. Coherence isn't a physical fluid. It's basically a measure of how much amplitude or dynamic capacity the mathematical field has available at any given point.
Okay.
Think of the lattice of 600 cell cavities as a completely rigid honeycomb. That's the substrate. The coherence is like the honey filling the comb.
Oh, okay. So the rigid honeycomb structure never changes its shape, but the amount of honey inside it can fluctuate.
Exactly. Now, bring your mind back to our standing wave. The particle beating its drum.
Right.
To sustain that constant vibrating oscillation, it requires energy. It acts like an active drain, continuously drawing in the field's coherence to keep its localized loop going.
So it's sucking the honey out of the local honeycomb to power itself.
Yes. And this creates a region of depleted coherence in the lattice surrounding the mass.
Oh, here's where it gets really interesting, because this completely reframes how we visualize gravity.
It really does.
We've all seen the standard high school analogy for gravity, right? A bowling ball sitting on a rubber trampoline, stretching the fabric of space so other marbles roll toward it.
Right, the curved space-time model.
But in this mechanism, the lattice does not bend like a rubber sheet. The math stays totally rigid. It is the coherence, the energy filling the lattice, that drains out towards the mass.
Exactly.
It is more like a rigid crystal structure where the atoms are locked rigidly in place, but the heat moving through it flows aggressively toward a cold spot.
That is an excellent way to visualize it. Furthermore, this depletion isn't uniform in all directions. It is anisotropic, which means uneven.
Uneven how?
Because the standing wave is vibrating along its chosen committed time axis, it drains the coherence much more deeply along that specific time direction than it does in the three spatial directions.
Oh, so it's drinking heavily from the time straw and barely sipping from the space straw.
Exactly. And this specific mechanism is what causes gravitational time dilation. You know, you are familiar with the fact that clocks tick slower the closer they are to a massive object like the Earth.
Yeah, like the GPS satellites in orbit have to constantly adjust their internal clocks because time literally moves faster out in space than it does for us down here on the surface.
Right. In Pentagon physics, the mechanism for time dilation is quite literal. The mass of the Earth is actively draining the coherence of the time axis.
Wow.
So a clock near the Earth simply has less coherence available to power the standing waves of its own atoms. So its internal drum is mechanically forced to beat slower.
That perfectly replicates the effects of Einstein's curved space-time, but with a completely different mechanical cause.
Exactly.
It's not a curved trampoline, it's a drained battery. But wait, if that static depletion profile is what we experience as gravity, what is a gravitational wave? Like, we know facilities like LIGO detect them when black holes collide.
Well, if gravity is simply the static depletion profile surrounding a mass, then a gravitational wave is just the rapid readjustment of that depletion profile.
Oh, I see.
When two black holes merge, they violently rearrange where the coherence is being drained.
Mm-hmm.
That readjustment just ripples outward through the rigid lattice.
Like the honey violently sloshing back into the honeycomb to find a new equilibrium after a massive disturbance.
Exactly. And it propagates at the speed of light, c, because that is the maximum speed the impedance of the lattice allows any perturbations to travel.
Right.
Which brings us to a beautiful unifying concept. Electromagnetic waves, light, and gravitational waves are actually siblings. They travel through the exact same medium, the 600-cell lattice, at the exact same speed.
Okay, but if they are siblings traveling through the same lattice, why is gravity so unbelievably weak compared to electromagnetism? I mean, if I hold a tiny refrigerator magnet over a paperclip, that tiny magnet easily overpowers the gravitational pull of the entire planet Earth.
It's a great question. And it comes down to the mechanical depth of the boundary crossings.
Boundary crossings.
Yeah. For an electromagnetic wave to propagate, the perturbation only has to cross the Galois boundary of the lattice once.
Okay.
That one crossing represents a coupling strength we call alpha, which is roughly 1 over 137. But gravity operates much deeper. For a gravitational wave to propagate, it has to mechanically interact with all 18 confined eigenmodes of the 600 cell.
Wait, so it has to cross the boundary 18 separate times?
Yes. The mass derives the gravitational coupling as alpha to the power of 18, multiplied by a geometric factor of 12 over 7.
Okay, let's do that math conceptually because it is just staggering.
It really is.
Alpha is roughly a fraction of 1 over 137. If you take a fraction that small and you multiply it by itself 18 times, taking it to the 18th power, you get a microscopic number.
Extremely microscopic.
You get a decimal point followed by 36 zeros, which perfectly explains why gravity is 10 to the 36th power times weaker than electromagnetism.
Exactly. It mathematically forces gravity to be exactly as weak as we observe it to be in reality.
Mm.
It is not a different magical force entirely.
Right.
It is just operating at a much deeper, more heavily muffled level of the exact same geometry.
That's incredible. Let's take a step back and just look at the sheer elegance of the mechanisms we've explored today.
Yeah.
In this framework, there are no separate particles just bumping around in an empty void. There is only one field, this rigid, mathematically perfect lattice generated by a single axiom.
Right.
Matter is simply what happens when that field crystallizes into a standing wave and chooses a timeline. Light Is the field communicating losslessly between those standing waves, passing energy like a perfect Newton's cradle because the walls literally can't read its AM radio signal?
Beautifully summarized.
And gravity is just the shadow, the anisotropic depletion of coherence that matter casts onto the field around it, forcing nearby clocks to tick slower.
It completely replaces a universe of disjointed, mysterious parts with a universe of inevitable, interconnected, geometric consequences.
So the next time you turn on a flashlight and watch the beam cut across the yard, or, you know, you feel your feet heavy on the floor, or you rely on the time from your phone's GPS, I really want you to picture the precise, relentless mathematics of the 600-cell lattice churning away invisibly right underneath your reality.
It really fundamentally reshapes how you visualize your interaction with the physical world.
It does. But before we wrap up, I want to leave you, the learner, with one final provocative thought.
Oh, this is a good one.
It is. It's inspired by the kill conditions section at the very end of the paper, where McLean lists exactly what empirical discoveries would prove his entire theory wrong. And it really got me thinking.
Yeah.
If our entire physical universe, all the mass, all the light, all the gravity, is simply the inevitable geometric consequence of the axiom sigma equals 1/1 plus sigma being true everywhere,
what would be the consequence of a different mathematical axiom asserting itself?
Exactly. What would happen if a completely different mathematical axiom were true somewhere else? Or even right here, superimposed over us.
Right, in the same space.
Could there be an entirely different universe with completely different physics, totally alien light, and unrecognizable gravity layered right on top of ours, simply born from a different mathematical truth that our specific boundary just can't read?
I mean, if reality is purely mathematical, then every self-consistent equation might very well be its own universe.
It's definitely something to mull over while you go about your day in this particular mathematical truth. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.